the place you can see it the best, interesting, you know, you said America, but Germany. So you can read articles about Germany. I read one the other day that talked about how Germany's economy is a complete disaster. It's in a deep recession. It's got nothing to show for itself. I think the Ukraine war was a major problem for them. But it's they've been getting the crap kicked out of them. The DAX has gone parabolic. So the markets no longer in any way respond to the realities of the world. And you can have potential bad news. Let's pretend tariffs are bad news. I have no idea, actually. These tariffs are a little different, right? There are a lot of noise, a lot of negotiating, a lot less tariffing, probably. The tariffs may look like a threat. There's three guys left in the world who've got the lack of brains. They're required to try to short, to sell it.
Dave Cullum, good morning to you. How are you?
Good. I'm up in the cabin, so the staging is both spectacular and poorly lit.
You look great. Never looked better.
Yeah, right. And had in a paper bag.
Right. You're not in the because of all the stuff that's hitting the fan, are you?
No. I don't even know what's hitting the fan. So I kind of pay attention, but you get lost up here. You kind of forget what time it is. You forget what day it is. I had forgotten I had a podcast until a 15-minute warning popped up on my computer, and I go, oh, okay.
Oh, it's Andy. Got to talk to Andy.
Got to talk to Andy. You're right.
You're exactly right. Well, okay. So let's jump into global macroeconomics. And you have a lot of wheelhouses, but that's one of your wheelhouses here. We've had 9 months of Trump, new policies and that sort of thing. Wanted to see what your thoughts were when all of that policies, are these working? Are you still expecting a significant downturn in the economy? And the economy, for the record, in my opinion, hasn't been great by any means. But yeah, let's start with that. Start giving your thoughts.
So Trump's a paradox. I mean, he started out unbelievably fast, signing executive orders in the rotunda and then later on in his office. And for the first month, it was euphoric for those of us who were looking for something spectacular, and it was better than expected. I think a lot of it has turned out to be as much headline as reality, and it's not to say that it won't eventually become reality, but I think there was a honeymoon period that was overstated, maybe. So Doge looked like they were really going to get in there and save money, and I'm not convinced they're going to save any money. And I've gotten into it with podcasters about the Big Beautiful Bill and how they think it was very important, and I go, it added trillions to our debt. So, and I said, look, at some point, you know, we're crack horse, and you either got to get off it or you got to. And they said, well, we'll do that later. And I said, that's what we always say. So, and, you know, Kennedy's been, who was to me the most predictable because he'd spent 30 years defining who he was. And all of a sudden, you don't quite know what's going on there. One day I'll say something really spectacular, and the next day I'll say something really insane, and you just don't know. He came up with the idea yesterday they were working on a universal vaccine, which I think is scientific nonsense. And unless they want to say vitamin C is now a vaccine and say, okay, well, that's good for you. And actually Tulsi Gabbard has held up pretty well in the report card category. But it's one of these things where if her claims that things are going to change are true, then it'll be spectacular. But if 3 years from now the Russia collusion squad is still unindicted co-conspirators, then that'll also just be headline stuff. My guess is that's to keep the opposing team from doing the same in reverse. So my guess is it's an attempt to get the right-wing offense on the field. and keep the left wing on the defense. That's my suspicion. Macroeconomically, the things Trump wants to do are much longer term, I think, than Trump. So let's say he's transformative. Let's be optimistic. If he's transformative, I think we'll know it in 10 years. We might see that he was sincerely trying to be transformative sooner than that, but it's a super tanker. You don't just change direction that quickly. We've got a lot of repair work to do. So I still see a serious problem coming, if for no other reason. The markets are so profoundly overvalued, and that never leads to good times in Party City, right? That's always a setup for pain and suffering. And I am at 200% over historical average valuation. I used to say fair value, but fair is an ambiguous word. And if you correct, 65, 70% just to get regressed to the mean, heaven forbid we go through it, it could get ugly, right? People are going to be grumpy. And most market tops, which is certainly, it has been attempting to form a top for many, many years, and it just refuses to stop being a top. It refuses to stop climbing. People are euphoric. And I don't know about you, but I don't sense euphoria anywhere, right? I mean, the roaring 20s were roaring. The nifty 50 in the 60s felt very technologically exciting. The dot-com era felt like the world had changed in a profound way. Even the real estate bubble of 07, everyone thought, we're all living the American dream. We're all having houses and stuff. And there are many of us who saw the problem coming. I wrote about it in 2002, which was obviously too early. This narrative is completely bizarre. The narrative is that the Fed somehow has superhuman ability to never let the market drop again. And that's insanity, in my opinion. And so never in the history of Arkansas has a market ever gotten way over historical average valuation that didn't eventually become cheap, which means we've got a cheapening in our future. There's a term for you that just popped out, a cheapening. And that's going to be a very painful experience. And it's, again, 200%. Jesse Felder has a new composite valuation index that hasn't set all time, never seen before, record highs, which I believe. But it's also unidentified. It's amorphous. So it's not like a dot-com bubble. They're trying to pretend like it's an AI bubble. It is not just an AI bubble. It's gotten into every crevice, every nook and cranny of the system, right? Whether it's housing, whether it's other equities. And you can say, well, the other equities aren't a bubble. I go, yeah, sure they are. Absolutely they are. They might have not been going bananas lately, but I had an epiphany. Bob Moriarty is binding all my annual reviews that I write, and it's going to turn out to be about 3,000 pages when they're all bound, which is a rather extraordinary number. And so I've had to proof of it. So the first one we did, we worked back to 2023, but then they jumped back all the way to 2009 to 2012. And they were very simple by comparison back then. So I was working on, I really just trying to understand things at a very simple level. I hate to say shallow, but simple. And they get more complex with time. The 2015 era is interesting because it was 10 years ago. And what I noticed is that something fundamentally has changed. A number of things have fundamentally changed. One is that you could write about a subject and you felt like you understood it. So you felt like you'd collected the facts, they fit together, and you could write a narrative. And nowadays, you can say Doge is, you don't know if Doge is working or not. You just have no idea. You have no idea if... you have no idea what happened, when Trump bombed Iran. You have no idea if they knocked out anything. There's just nothing that you can say with confidence. And so I'd say I wrote with much greater confidence, which may or may not have been because the facts weren't so scrambled. Mike Benz at one point said that around 2013, the deep state figured out that they were losing the narrative. And so they had to solve that problem in AI. Instead of trying to suppress speech, which they did many times, actually, but the signal keeps showing up. They increase the noise levels, and so so you can find the facts, but they're deeply embedded in this morass of crazy stuff that you don't know what to make of it. And so I'm finding it hard to think about stuff. I'm finding it difficult. Last year, I titled my year review, "What is a Fact?" Right? And this year, I'm going to do something a little different. I'm going to dig into a topic I've been working on for 3 years on the darkness of the world of Macron and trafficking and all that stuff. And that's, I've been working on a lot. So it's going to be a little bit less of a year review and a little bit more of a write what I want to write about, in part because I think the chaos is not worth writing about. So what do you write about Doge? What do you write about Elon Musk? What do you write about Trump and Elon having on again, off again? I find none of that interesting. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to kind of take a break from it being an annual review, although there'll be that component. And even that seems to be hard to find, right? I looked at the anecdotes I had from 10 years ago, and they seemed remarkably entertaining, a lot of them. And I think my sources are inferior now. I think Twitter's become a swamp. I think Zero Hedge has become far less edgy and deep. And far more a bunch of Wall Street guys just writing research reports. And so Zero Hedge is not anywhere near as good a source as it used to be. And my Twitter feed is just a total cesspool of noise. 10 years ago, I probably had 1,000 followers. And I probably followed, 200 people. And now it's orders of magnitude above that, but therefore it's of no value. It's of limited value to me. So macroeconomically speaking, I think we are potentially in a recession. I think we've been potentially in one for a long time because, as you know, inflation numbers are grotesquely underestimated. And if they're reporting a GDP of 2.5-3%, and the inflation numbers are off by 4%, then it means you're actually shrinking your economy. And on top of that, if you look at what's growing, Facebook and, stupid companies like that, it doesn't feel like wealth at all. It doesn't feel durable. It's not like you've created a new rail system. It's not, you can say, well, digital, you have digitally, but it just seems to be garbage to me. If Facebook dissolved today, I wouldn't notice it missing at all. And Twitter would be disappointing because it's kind of like the phone of watching TV. So it'd be like if you took away my TV or something, it doesn't make you more productive. It doesn't. And Microsoft, they make the same stuff they've always made, right? There's not. When I reached a point where I could paste a graphic into a Word file, that was pretty much the epitome of efficiency for me. And then there's this crazy, the overvaluation story. So at 15, I made, in my opinion, was a profoundly compelling case that the markets had not only rallied back from the 09 low, which was not very low. If you look at valuation metrics, we plumbed sort of historical fair average valuation, got a little below it, spent about a month below it, and then boinked right back thanks to $30 trillion of what they like to call stimulus, which is a euphemism for inflation. But by 15, what's interesting about the year 15 is it's this weird composite of we had learned what had happened in 08, 09 and had worked through a lot of it. And we were starting to notice that no one was going to get arrested, nothing was going to change and stuff like that. So the 15 was a good year to sort of analyze the disaster, do a post-game recap. But what's also true is using stats, using graphs, using all the usual tools, using quotes from the world's most famous investors, you know, Druckenmillers and Gundlachs and Paul Tudor Jones. They all said the markets had become ridiculous again and were heading off a precipice. Now, what has happened since 2015? Straight up. And I don't think any of those guys would have believed if you had told them back then that it would go another 10 years. And I don't think any of them would have. I don't think anyone saw that coming. So, and that's how you get the 200% over historical average valuation. So something is elevating these markets in almost a sci-fi kind of way where you know, the place you can see it the best, interesting, you know, you said America, but Germany. So you can read articles about Germany. I read one the other day that talked about how Germany's economy is a complete disaster. It's in a deep recession. It's got nothing to show for itself. I think the Ukraine war was a major problem for them. But they've been getting the crap kicked out of them. The DAX has gone parabolic. So the markets no longer in any way respond to the realities of the world. And you can have potential bad news. Let's pretend tariffs are bad news. I have no idea, actually. These tariffs are a little different, right? There are a lot of noise, a lot of negotiating, a lot less tariffing, probably. The tariffs may look like a threat. There's three guys left in the world who've got the lack of brains. They're required to try to short, to sell it, right? And then it passes and the world kept spinning and it wasn't a big disaster. And all of a sudden, millions appear to buy the dip.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got this totally non-symmetric response to news. When the bad news is there, you got the three guys who are willing to short the market. And when it turns into not such bad news or good news, everyone wants to buy it. And so that's how you elevate. You get the Mike Green story right, where it's passive flows. I mean, well, that's never going to stop. Mike Green says it is stopping. It you know it will stop. You know it will stop at some unknown future date, but at some point it's going to reverse. One could argue, you know, as the boomers have to start spending down their money. If the market somehow starts correcting, then all of a sudden people start liquidating. If you've got an S&P 500 Vanguard fund and you decide you want to sell, in the olden days, you would say, oh, I should sell that NVIDIA, or I should sell. Now you can sell the entire market with one click. And so it is going to be a market-wide. And if you think you're buying a good stock because it's a value play, first of all, make sure you're using the absolute metric of value. So if you say the small caps have never been this cheap compared to the large caps, whatever argument you want to make, be careful. Your metric is the wrong metric. What you want to do is say, is the cash flow of the small caps higher than it's ever been, right? Relative to the market cap, things like that. Those are absolute values of valuation. A husband once went through the analysis. He says, when markets sell off all 10 deciles of valuation, you break it into 10 deciles of dirt cheap, probably for a reason, expensive, arguably for a reason, they all sell off about the same. And so by the end of a big problem, you're selling your grandchildren, you're selling your children, you're selling your house, you're selling everything.
Right, right?
Yeah, you're right. And literally in the Depression, there were actually parents giving away their kids.
Okay. Yeah.
And again, this doesn't feel like a euphoric top. And so on top of all this, if you take the average boomer who's still pissed at the COVID story and still pissed at the Ukraine story and still pissed at the, you know, Israel-Gaza story, which they won't say anything about, but you can't watch that and go, wait a minute, this is a problem. And then you take away half their net worth. So all of a sudden, the salve that was keeping them from losing their shit has now been removed, right? And, you know, if you lose 10% off your retirement account, you just took a 10% pay cut. And you go, well, they got pay raises repeatedly for the last 10 years, right? And it's rather extraordinary. So, for example, the example I like to use, let's start real simple. If I've already said this, just stop me. But if the end of the .com drop and then rebuild, Buffett lamented hanging on to Coca-Cola. Now, that didn't get a lot of press. And what most people think is Buffett would never sell Coke because he's in love with the goddamn company. But he did lament it. And the reason he did is because Coke had hit a PE of 50 in 1998. And that means to a guy like Buffett is they had a 2% cash flow. And Buffett knows that if you got a 2% cash flow, that's the return on your investment, right? Think of stocks and bonds just being cash flows. You're getting a 2% return. It could go up from there, but it could go down from there, right?
Significantly, right.
Significantly. And that was a time when 10-year treasuries, I think it was, were trading around 6%. So Buffett realized that he hung on to a 2% when he could have had an absolute rock solid safe 6%. So now you go to the 2015 to 2025 window, Microsoft, its revenues are up 150%. You go, oh, that's really good, which imparts inflation, right? But its share price is up tenfold. And my math tells me that the share price should crudely track the revenue growth, right? You look at Apple, which hasn't invented anything new that I can see. I'm sure there's some cloud shit, right? But I don't care about the cloud shit.
Apple invented I just got a new iPhone and they invented a new cord that I had to go buy.
And it's the same phone though. It's the same phone. Right.
Yeah, it's not they're generating revenue, is exchanging the how I plug my phone in and not.
So Apple's up tenfold. And its revenues are up 50%.
Yeah.
So one could argue to undo that expansion of valuation. That's a 95% correction. Now, got to be careful because they did share buybacks. So instead of looking at share price, arguably you should look at market cap. And the numbers shrink a little. So it's like Apple's up, you know, sixfold with a 50% revenue. And that accounts for it, but it doesn't account for the fact that they burned their balance sheet down to a nub. So you kind of got to back that out. And I don't know quite how to think about that, but so all these, and NVIDIA, right? NVIDIA's revenues are up 25-fold, right? So they're trying to label this the AI bubble, which I think is a fake. And the reason I think the label of the AI bubble is fake is it's almost like they want to ring fence it so that when it goes to shit, they can say, okay, just sell the AI stocks.
Right.
Buy Coca-Cola, revenue, whatever, right? You know, and I don't think that will work. But NVIDIA is up 25-fold increase in revenues. Now their profit margins are ridiculous, and profit margins mean regress like nothing else. But also on top of that, Huang has got a history of being a slime ball. And on top of that, their share price is up 250-fold. So a 90% correction using share price would get them back to where they were in 2015. And 2015 is not ancient times, right? And it's also not a time where you think of it as like a super deep low, since Paul Tudor Jones say we're about to sail off a cliff, right? You got Dunlop and you got Druckenmiller saying the markets are ridiculous and how did this happen? And that's what I woke up to in reading the proofing the 2013, 14, 15 annual reviews is that things have changed. The availability of information has changed. The markets have got super ridiculous off of super ridiculous already highs. So the rally was too fast. By 15, it had gotten over the top again. And the big guns couldn't understand how that happened again. And then since then, I don't know what the S&P's done, but I haven't committed that to memory, but it's way, way, way up. And I think it'll all be given back. And whether it's given back in a big whoosh, which I don't think so, because dips always get bought, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think the market will drop. Like, look at what happened. Here's a great example. 2020, right?
Yep.
We had a pandemic that was oversold by an order of magnitude. We shut down the entire global economy. And the markets are up 13%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are they responding to anything?
Right.
So the markets remind me, I keep thinking metaphors, the markets remind me of an overtired two-year-old where you're trying to reel them in and the kid's just not listening.
Yeah.
And you go, this is going to end in tears. This is going to end up with a whack in the ass before it's over. And then there's going to be tears. There's going to be unhappiness. And, you know, but we got to get a response out of this kid. Right. Yeah. And so I do not believe, even theoretically, the feds can elevate, that the authorities can elevate the markets in perpetuity. And if they can, then they're elevating it at a cash flow that was much like Coca-Cola.
Mm-hmm.
And so right now, the Case-Shiller PE, from 1880 to 1990, the Case-Shiller PE averaged around 12 or 13, right? You know, that's a baseline, right? If you're not willing to give me 110 years to define a baseline, then that doesn't seem fair to me. From 1990, actually from 94, it's a magic year that I don't quite understand, but 1994, every valuation metric left the channel. It could be saving the bond market. Could be, I don't know what it is that made 94 look like a discontinuity, but it does. But from 1990 to the present, the Case-Shiller PE, which is just one of 25 metrics I watch, went from the channel, which was in and out of averaging 13, to it's currently sitting at 38. So there's your 200% right there.
Right.
And the people who like to average the Case-Shiller PE, they usually go back to around 1950. In the last 40 years, last 30 years, it's had a huge effect on that average. So it's kind of numbs it, where you say, well, okay, it's only this much above average. And I go, it's historically this. And I go, no, it's not historically that. It's historically much lower. 30 years of recency bias, I'd call it 40 years, 45 years of recency bias, from 81 to the present, the equity markets have treated us like kings. And it is totally forgivable for people to think that that will never stop. Just like the Soviet Union lasts, 70 years?
Yeah.
But it stopped.
And
it stopped. Stein's Law. We're back to Stein's Law.
Really quick it stopped.
Yeah, really quick.
So you brought up a lot of things, and I think that actually kind of, there's a question in here, but I want to make a few observations. Things do stop. They just do, but we don't know when. They can go a lot longer than we think they are. But really my question is, not that I think that the Fed, and I don't think that the Fed can prop up whoever can prop up the moments.
The authorities.
Right. Yeah, I like it. Yeah. Okay, but that really leads into my question. Well, I hope it's a question. It's a thought. They almost have to, right? Because this ties in, and I want to touch on what you're working on. You mentioned Macron. I'm very curious. I think I know what you're going to say, but I'm very curious. But it kind of ties into Doge, Epstein, Macron, whatever. They have to keep it going, right? Because if they don't keep it going, we're going to have pitchforks here, and, you know, it's going to get really, really ugly.
I agree.
So
Fourth turning, right?
Right. Great book, right?
Yeah.
So that is my thesis, but I think you have to unlayer that. They have to keep it going. and how the authorities.
So what I would say is I'd clarify that and say they have to try to keep it going.
Yes, I would agree with you. They have to try to keep it going. And how they're doing is just what they always done is just print, just flood the system with money. Because that's how you get stocks at these valuations markets at these highs, if you would. And everything is air quotes fine. Okay. But I'll tell you what, I live in the suburbs of Atlanta, Georgia here. And just over the past 10 years, you mentioned 10 years, very nice suburbs, very pleasant. I am seeing, and this is nothing against homeless people and the downtrodden or whatever, but I am seeing a
feel great compassion for them, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I'm seeing a huge influx of homeless people in my suburb.
Where you're supposed to be safe from that sort of exposure.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. This is not downtown Atlanta, which is a mess. But this is, again, air quotes, safe suburbs. And just in the past 10 years, I've seen a significant increase in that. And also, I noticed this. I drive by strip malls or shopping centers or whatever, and I just do a test. What businesses are occupying these buildings? And it's either no occupancy, or it's, you know, again, this is nothing against nail salons or, you know, a cell phone company or whatever, but it's lower end. It's not a name brand, high end.
Right. And they're all gone. They're all gone.
Yeah.
And that's a consequence, I think, of the digital world, right? Of the Amazon, right?
Yeah.
Peter Bookfire, I spend a lot of time with him in every fall. And he points out, interesting, the strip mall world is healthier than the mall world, because if you look at what's in strip malls, there's liquor stores and things like that.
Yeah.
And laundromats, dry cleaners, you know, things, nail salons. And you need them. And
yeah.
So they're actually a safer sort of commercial real estate bet than buying, you know, Destiny Mall in Syracuse and having it declared Chapter 11 last week. Huge mall. But there's also a tremendous number of these Potemkin stores where you walk by and you go, oh, it's a tractor store, but there's no one in there. There's just tractors parked in the store.
Yeah.
You know, because they want to make it look like it is not a dying mall.
Right.
You'll see stores with, you know, entertainment in it, like where kids can go and play, and you go, that's not exactly a high profit margin business you're running there.
Yeah.
So they must be essentially giving away the rent. And it'll be things like, now the malls will have some, like an Edward Jones brokerage office or something, you know.
So right.
But yeah, somehow the digital world, we've all signed off on it. We've paid a pretty high price for it, in my opinion. I think the convenience of Amazon is so undeniable, but the inconvenience of not being able to walk into a store and try stuff on and do stuff is also undeniable. And what's also true is we knocked out all the mom and pop restaurants and stuff, and now your choice is to go to Chipotle or McDonald's drive through and whatever.
But it also goes, I think, and ties together in the sense, I was talking with another guest that I had on recently. It's like, what do you believe? Well, it's so hard to get to truth, if you would. So, for example, you mentioned in the beginning of this, Doge, you know, hey, and I was very optimistic. I was like, that's actually happening.
Very.
Actually happening. Now, what's going on? I mean, am I greedy and like I want an update? Is stuff happening besides the scenes? But really, what's going on? And it goes back to like the whole Epstein, Macron, where is the stuff? When's the stuff coming? And it's not going to come. But why? You know what I'm saying? So I've been lied to.
Well, they promised to save us money, right? They promised to get rid. They dissolved USAID.
Yeah.
Right. And I did a Tucker Carlson interview. It's been so long. had four reschedules of it, and then it's kind of post a month after it got recorded. I don't remember even what we talked about. I mean, I that's true for most podcasts. For me, I get the other guy, what did we talk about again? But Tucker, it was really complicated because we spoke for an hour and a half before and an hour and a half afterwards. And some of it got real dark in ways that you and I have talked offline on. And I was stunned at how dark Tucker was. And you and I can talk offline about that again, because I don't want to say what Tucker said to me. Three times he said, you're not recording, right? And so you can imagine.
I'm dying here.
Yeah, we'll do that unofficially. Where was I going with that?
Believe how dark things are.
Yeah. And he gets good guests and they tell dark stories. I mean, he seems to be trying to out the bad guys as much as anyone. I still haven't quite figured out who he is. First approximation, he seemed kind of like, you see, what you see is what you get. Mm. So the guy I sort of chatted with was the same guy you see on Twitter for the most part. But I don't know what's true. I'm reading Jerome Corsi's book called Coup d'etat. And it's about the Russia collusion, which what makes it interesting is we're about to get told stuff. And Jerome Corsi wrote this book, published it about a year ago. And so I'm getting the answer key in advance of getting the answer key, right? So now Jerome got deposed for 40 hours himself on the Russia collusion story. They tried to throw him in jail, and he knows Roger Stone and all these guys. And so he was up to his ass in the Russia collusion story. And he's in a doctor Zoom group with me, and I get to chat with him occasionally. As recently as maybe a week and a half ago. And what you get from coup d'etat is the unbelievably dark bullshit that they do to each other behind the scenes, right? That the Russiagate story was global. Many countries were involved in helping that story get legs. The whole thing was fabricated. You are left with the sense that if there was a justice system that worked, which is very hard to make that case now, it doesn't seem to work for the little guy or the big guy. The little guy seems to get hammered. The big guy never goes to jail, never goes to jail. When I say, when was the last person went to jail who was rich and powerful? You can't name them, right? But you're left with a sense that guys like Obama should do 20 years, that Hillary should do 20 years, right? They're really, really high crimes and misdemeanor sort of criminality. And it's so, there's so many law firms that specialize in ripping people's souls out, things like that. And it's just so dark. And like Papadopoulos was a 29-year-old neophyte who had no idea what shark infested waters he was getting into. And so he was not ready to defend himself at all. Of course, he's an interesting guy to talk to because he's written 30 books. I mean, he's been there and done that. There is this sense that the whole world is like the Roman Senate, right? And they're just ready to stab each other. And it's at our expense, right? All these games are at our expense. And that's where the pitchforks and the torches come out. And if I read a book on human behavior, I warned Tucker, actually. I said two things you got to worry about. One is I move around during interviews. So I said I wiggle. So since I had to sit at a mic, well, they just basically rammed me up against the table anyway, so I couldn't have moved from the mic. I said the second thing is I jumped topic. So I got a little, you know, ADHD, you know, and I said, blind knot occasionally finds a squirrel. And he said, "Oh, I'm going to steal that one." And I warned them, they had to reel me in. But God, I lost my train of thought again. I'm obviously distracted this morning by some stuff that you know about. It's dark, and it could get very dark. We've got this idea that the United States is always self-repairing, right? Jonathan Turley's book, The Indispensable Right, is about free speech. It's about the history of free speech through the lens of the Supreme Court. And it is staggering. Jonathan Turley. It's a great book. In fact, I told Tucker, I said, it's the book for you, dude. I said, you of all people should read this book. And but free speech comes and goes. It ebbs and flows. And during tough times, it tends to go away. And there was a guy who was passing out pamphlets opposing World War I. And he got arrested, thrown in jail, and the Supreme Court upheld the decision. Right? So there have been tough times. Now, so you say, okay, it ebbs and flows right now. It's on some ebb or flow. That's not very good. But when you listen to Turley interview, and he hasn't been on a big book tour. I don't quite know why, but I didn't notice him out there hacking. But the few interviews I saw, he seemed to be pessimistic that this one would go back to normal. He seems concerned that we're on some dark path that we're gonna have trouble pulling out of.
Yeah, it's hard not to disagree with that. And again, I don't know if this is my own moods or my own circumstances, but I get a
well, you're a microcosm of the world, though. The fact that your own mood is here is sort of, you're one of many people whose mood is here.
Yeah, well, right. And I go from mildly optimistic to where I was very optimistic to now. Very, I don't want to say pessimistic, but it's like, it's not going to happen. Things aren't
disappointed.
Disappointed. Disappointed. That's a good word. And now I am pessimistic. I just don't believe anything's really going to happen. And
So people who I sort of cling to Trump support, cling is the word. Yeah. And people who don't like Trump can't imagine why we support him. And they go, you don't understand. We're not really supporting him. We believe that if not Trump, then nobody. Mm-hmm. Right? That's the problem. Trump, if you can't take a guy as idiosyncratic and bombastic and aggressive and impervious to pain as Trump and change the system, the next one's not going to do it.
No way. No way. You're absolutely right. And that's what, again, comes in my disappointment as well. It's like, it's not only Epstein files not being released or whatever, but it's also the escalation of war. But then that was quick. But then it's the escalation of the Middle Eastern war. What's going on with that? And I was told and believed optimistically that was all going to go away and end.
Yeah, he said he'd end the Ukraine war fast. I was talking to a Canadian analyst. He's on Intel, but he's an analyst. He gets to go to meetings. He says he's self-described, not a big swinging dick, but he gets to go to meetings with the big swinging dicks. And we chat. And I think the reason we chat is because everyone else in his world that he chats with, he has to look over his shoulder. Whereas he can chat with me and I can hold up a conversation and I have no horse in the race.
Right.
And he said, much to my shock, he said, this Ukraine war is going to go on for years. And then I was on a Zoom call. I saw with Alex Craner.
Great guest, by the way. Great guest.
Great guest, yes.
Great guy. I texted him.
And Alex basically says that Europe is going to bet the ranch on grabbing up Ukraine's resources because they don't have any. And that if they don't get them, they're screwed. And I'm thinking, and I said to him in several different ways, I said, you know, it's not their resources, though, right? And it sounds naive because people say, well, yeah, babe, that's not how the world works. I go, yeah, but it's the fact that's not how the world works. It bothers me so much, though, right?
Right.
That we're willing to kill a million Ukrainians because we want their farmland.
Yeah. Or whatever else is over there. Or
whatever else is over there.
Yeah. Or not to get too much in the weeds with the Middle East, but we're willing to try to thread the needle supporting Saudi, who I don't really have a problem supporting or taking their oil. Don't get me wrong. But also,
look, while they're bombing the shit out of Yemen.
Yeah, there you go. Right?
That's right.
Okay.
And no one even bitched about that. I wrote about that. I said, yeah, you know.
There you go.
When Khashoggi died, I said, you know, I called him ODK, one dead Khashoggi. And I wrote about it. I said, look, I don't give a shit about Khashoggi. He went into the Saudi embassy. This is a dangerous place. Bodies show up a lot in this world. Why do I care about ODK, right? And meanwhile, we're bombing, we're killing tens of thousands of Yemenis. You go, well, those are the Saudis. I go, yeah, with our weapons and our authorization. If we said no, they wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
If Gonzalo Lira, who had been captured by Zelensky, if we had made a phone call and said, you got to give him back, we would have gotten him back. But we let Zelensky kill him.
Yeah. So it's like, I guess where I'm at, it's like, it's hard to process. And what does one do with all of this? And I come to the conclusion, just have a few really, really good sources, if you would. And then just, and this is kind of, this doesn't sound like much, but all I can do is take care of my own house and my neighbor, right, if you would, and my family.
But you also have to speak up. So when I wrote about Ukraine,
not that, Dave, you've been great about that, by the way.
I wrote about Ukraine, and it's one of those things I had to first find it on a map, you know. I'd been reading about it because I picked up the 2014 Color Revolution thread, and off and on, I wrote small amounts about Putin and Ukraine and NATO and incursion into Ukraine. And I view it as an incursion into Ukraine. I had concluded that Putin was the right guy to run Russia, right?
Right? No, I agree. Go ahead.
And, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, could Justin Trudeau or Ahern, you know, run Russia? No, the answer is no. And you go, well, you know, he kills people. I go, we don't? What are you talking about, right?
Right.
And so I think he's a nationalist, and that's the biggest problem, because we don't like nationalists. We like globalists.
Yeah.
And I like Viktor Orban. You know, mm-hmm. I think he's a good guy. I like Maloney, the Italian Maloney. Yeah, I paid less attention to him, but yes. Part of it's because I just don't believe that Argentina is not going to blow the hell up again. So it seems it's just
100 years. Yeah.
Yeah. How many times? Right. And, So, the Ukraine war to me was, I put rounding to the nearest integer 100% on NATO. I think that Putin begged us not to push him.
Mm-hmm. He did.
And it was the toddler that you couldn't get control of. And he kept saying, look, you know, Ukraine is existential for us. You can't have it. He wasn't saying he wanted it. He said, we can't have it. He was very clear on that.
Yeah.
And they misquote him. And did you know that? So I was doing a podcast one day with Danielle Camboni, maybe. And she made some reference to BRICS and the importance of it. I said, well, how many countries now are associated with BRICS? And she says about 25. And I said, that's a big number, right? Including some oil-rich countries. And I said, and they had a meeting, didn't they, just recently? And she said, yeah. And I said, where was it? She said, Moscow. I said, that kind of answers your question. So we've done everything we can to demonize Moscow, demonize Russia. And 25 countries have said, we're going with the Russians and the Chinese.
Right.
And so I'm talking to Steve Hanke one day, who lives and dies for currencies, right? Hanke is currency. He sees he sees dollar bills in the air, you know, that no one else can see. You know, he's a currency guy. And I said, BRICS is not about a currency. It's about alliances. He said, you're absolutely correct. It doesn't matter what currency they use. It's 25 countries saying we're now going with the other team. And that's a huge problem for us. And then there was a Putin held a press conference in the top floor of Gazprom, which was a spectacular view, you can imagine. I was probably in Moscow, I don't remember. And he had international journalists, a dozen of them in the room. And for 3 hours, he just took questions. And it turns out that there's a transcript of it, translated, et cetera. And it's truly an awesome interview. And one of the things about, you ever listen to a Putin interview, he doesn't bullshit you. He'll just tell you, like he said, well, why did you jail Khodorkovsky? And he said, well, he stole billions of dollars. I go, well, that pretty much is true. Right? You know, why'd you kill this guy? Well, he's a douchebag. And Putin just answered, took question after question. One guy said, well, I have another, but I'll wait. And he said, well, you might not get another chance. So you might as well do it, right? You know, and I've been so impressed. And I've heard he doesn't bluff, which is scary when he says something gnarly, because I go, that's not a bluff. I can't find anyone who knows about this conference. I even reached out to Jeff Sachs, said, are you aware he had a press conference with international press? He did not know that. It's got no press. It was a spectacular press conference, but we're not going to cover it, right? So I think no matter what, Europe is going to lose Ukraine. I think if they push their luck, they're going to lose more than they had to. Because if I'm Putin, if they make me fight, I'm taking the whole damn thing.
Yeah. Well, it leads into what's interesting is, like, they're going to have a summit up in Alaska, right? Trump and Putin. Do you think anything's going to come out of that?
I have no idea. I think when those two are meeting, the work has already been done.
Yeah.
So who would be the analog of Lavrov in the United States? Rubio? Would that be Rubio?
I think so, yes.
Who, by the way, has been surprisingly good.
Yeah.
He was my last choice of all the appointments. I'm going, you picked Rubio? Really? He has been really, really good. Now, he might be doing things we don't like if we knew what he was doing. Right. But his capacity to handle gnarly Trump haters has been spectacular.
Yeah.
He bitch slaps him. I mean, he really.
Even world leaders.
Right.
You know, I've been very, very surprised, pleasantly surprised, more than pleasantly surprised, very happy. And I would never have thought that.
I was not a Rubio fan at all. And then, of course, now J.D. Vance is invisible.
Right.
What's that about?
Right.
Tulsi Gabbard is now out there in view. I do believe, though, that the whole Russia collusion thing is really just Trump putting his offense on the field.
Yeah. Do you think anything will happen, or do you think people will,
I think these guys will suffer some serious shame, which I think is good. I don't think there'll be any jail time.
Yeah.
But I think I would love for the left to discover that Obama and these guys are evil. Because I think he is. I'd like them to have to face that. There is the million-dollar question is, where is Trump's corruption? And that gets to the Epstein question. And you know, photo bombing, oh, that's spam. Photo bombing pictures of Trump and Epstein mean nothing. Now, they knew each other a lot, so Trump had to know that Epstein was not a good guy. But supposedly also Trump disowned him about 20 years ago, so one could make the argument that it's finally clicked. If I had a better paycheck, I'd say Trump is in no way compromised in the Epsteinian sort of way, right? I also suspect the reason the Epstein story blew up is because when they finally got to see what was going on, they said, holy shit, we can't release this.
Yeah, that goes back to it all falls apart if they don't keep it going, right?
Well, what if you find out that four Supreme Court justices were banging 5 years? Yeah. Right. So then the question comes down to, do you really want to burn the system to the ground for justice? There's a movie called The Independent, starring, of all people, John Cena. And he's the independent running against the two parties. And then you find out he did some slimy shit. Then the good guys in the movie sort of had to make the decision to let him get away with it. The journalists who could have outed him, they had to make the decision whether to let John Cena get away with it because of a lesser of two evil thing.
Yeah.
And so my conclusion is that there's many people who should be in prison for many decades on the Russia collusion story. It wasn't just hijinks. It was real. The coup d'etat is not hyperbole.
Mm-hmm.
I would agree. Well, I'll look at this. Look at this. Look at that little guy.
Yeah. I wish I was him some days.
She's our newest. He's our newest Boston Terrier. We have 4 Boston Terriers.
That's awesome.
And a lab, big fat lab.
Well, Dave, I think we're going to wrap up. I'd love for you to stay on for about 15 minutes afterwards to chat briefly. I do have to go for another interview. Okay.
Say hi to Martin for me. I've never met him. He doesn't know it, but we actually exchanged a little bit of information when he was in prison.
I'll let him know.
Yeah, it went through, as I recall, it went through his daughter. He wouldn't remember. He wouldn't know me.
Yeah, well, I'll name him.
But I know him.
Yeah. Well, thanks for your time, Dave. We'll get this right out and stay on afterwards.
Okay. Thanks for inviting me.